The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Retired Wright-Patterson Air Force Base senior engineer Raymond Szymanski is the award-winning author of Alien Shades of Grey Trilogy, who is the acknowledged expert on Wright-Patterson's Alien Connections. Raymond has appeared on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens show, the Discovery Channel's Expedition X, premiere episodes and local morning news shows on all the major networks. He has been quoted and misquoted in every major UK tabloid, including The Sun, The Express, and The Daily Mail. His 50-plus radio appearances include Coast to Coast AM with George Knapp and Open Minds with Alejandro Rojas, and his 40-plus public presentations include the 2019 UFO MegaCon in Laughlin, Nevada, and the Children of the Stars Conference in Milan, Italy. Raymond holds a Bachelor of Electrical and Electronics Engineering from the University of Detroit. In 1983, he completed his graduate studies in computer engineering at Wright State University. In his distinguished engineering career, Raymond received two of the most prestigious Air Force Civilian Awards, the Air Force Civilian Achievement Award, and the Outstanding Civilian Career Service Award. And we're honored to have him with us today on the show. So welcome to the show, Ray.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. And tell our listeners, what got you interested in the UFO phenomenon in the first place?
It's great. A great question to start with. In January of 1973, I reported to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a cooperative education student out of the University of Detroit. And what that meant is that I had agreed to work there for 4 months, earn some money for college tuition. And then I would rotate, go back to school for a semester, then come back and do a work study. And that was the program that was set up at the University of Detroit so that the engineers could get some out of the classroom type, real life, real world experience. And 4 of us were selected to go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and do this, what we called a co-op session. So here it is. It's the first week. It's January of 1973. And I was assigned a mentor who was a mid-level manager in the office that I was assigned to. And he says to me, hey, let's go through this empty hangar into the other part of this building structure. So you had a 2-story structure on the south side connected to a 250-foot long unused airplane hangar. And on the other side was a matching 2-story business office. So we were in the area with all some early computer type stuff and management stuff, and then go through this empty hangar and then go to the coffee shop. So as we exited our building and go into this really dark, spooky hangar to get to the other side, he turns to me and said, "Have you heard about our aliens?" Well, I'm a 19-year-old college student from Detroit, and I know nothing about aliens. And so I ask him about it, and eventually the story comes out that there was a crash out west in the 40s, and the machines and the occupants were brought to Wright-Patterson for evaluation and exploitation. And you can imagine my reaction, thinking, "Oh, this guy's spoofing me or something, not sure what's going on here." So, I was asking questions like, "Well, all right, where is this stuff?" "Well, it's in the tunnels." "Oh, we have tunnels." Imagine, it's my first week at Wright-Patterson. I know absolutely nothing. I've barely gotten in the gate. The seat I'm using in my office is barely warm. And he said, "Well, we have them in the tunnels." I said, "Well, can we go see these things in the tunnels?" And he goes, "No, we can't." "Well, why not?" "Well, it's a secret." "Well, geez, Al, if it's a secret."
The secret that he just told you, right?
Right. "If it's a big secret, how do you know about it?" Well, as the days, weeks, and months unfold, I talk to other people. I go, "You know what Al told me? Tell me about aliens." And everyone's like, "Yeah." I go, "What?" They're all in on this. Well, what I didn't realize at that time was that there was this large across-the-base awareness of Project Blue Book, having been there for, signed Grudge and Blue Book for 22 years, literally hundreds of yards across from where I was working. And they were all aware of the connection between Wright-Patterson and Project Blue Book. Plus, there were TV shows. It was that activity was always in the newspapers. And I arrived in 1973. So that's only 4 years after Blue Book closed its doors. And there was a lot of latent publicity about, what Wright-Patterson, are they still doing this stuff? So it was always popping up sporadically on the news, the local news, the newspapers. And even today, anybody who works on base, if you ask them and you go, "Hey, can you tell me about the aliens?" they know something about the heritage of Wright-Patterson and flying saucers. So when I was there, very close to the terminus of the Project Blue Book, a lot of people were still very much aware of that. And so now I'm just curious, like, what is this? And I spent those next several weeks on base at any opportunity. If I was going to a luncheon with somebody, I'd ask them, "Hey, what do you know about this?" And the responses weren't homogeneous, or a lot of unevenness, but everyone was well aware of that connection. So that's where it all started for me. And I basically snooped around for the next 40 years.
Wow. So you were there 40 years.
I was there from January of 1973 until the last day of September in 2011. So my career at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which I left as a senior scientist / engineer, spanned 5 decades. I had 38 years and 9 months of service when I retired, and actually would probably have been there another couple of years. But in November of 2010, a young man ran a red light in front of me, and I crashed into his car, and I wound up with some serious neck issues and some other physical issues. Mm-hmm. And I was having these blackout headaches because of the ruptured disc in my neck.
Wow.
And I was on these heavy pain killers that would just knock me out. And I decided, and I was actually on a program that we were doing flight testing, and we were going out at a location to do flight testing 3 weeks at a time. And I could no longer do that. So I decided to retire. So I retired early, but I have plenty of time and I have no regrets.
So was it now I'm being nosy. Was it a medical retirement or?
No, I could have selected a medical retirement because they were going to actually do surgery and stuff. But I had a brilliant surgeon who said, "Hey, you're healthy." I was still running. I've run 16 marathons, two Bostons. I've run dozens and dozens and dozens of other races, half marathons, 10Ks, 5Ks. So I was in great shape. And he said, "You know, you're like a 50-year-old. You're very healthy. Let's wait, because I think that, you know, with some therapy, I think we can get that disc to shrink back and drop back off the nerve, which is causing you the problem. We don't have to do surgery." And but I felt at that point that I couldn't fulfill the duties, especially the program that I was on. I wanted to continue. And I thought, it's time to pull the plug. This is a sign from somewhere that I need to do something different.
Yeah.
And so I retired in September of 2011.
Was the physical therapy successful?
Yeah, because I had other issues. I had tears and sprains in my leg because, you know, I'm hitting a car at high speed and he's fully broadside and I'm going like this. My airbag is blown off in my face. A truck hits me from behind after I hit the car in front of me, and my Accord became an accordion, just freaking totaled it. So I was in kind of bad shape. You know, it was enough was enough.
Yeah. How long ago was this?
This was, it was the 16th of November in 2010. And the therapy, you know, was basically for the lower extremities. My arm was messed up. And again, these were just pulls and tears and twists and you know, other medical terms. But I actually have the MRIs that show the damage in my neck. And so we did some therapy for that. But it was basically, you know, light stretching. I have a Teeter's incline, you know, a chair that you can flip upside down,
right,
and you hang upside down, that kind of thing, massage, deep heat. There were just things to try to get the shrinking to happen, and it worked. And I still have to be careful, and I basically had to give up those marathons and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to know that you're much better now.
Thank you. Thank you. Much more functional.
Very good. So after working at Wright Pat for almost 40 years, what ET info were you able to garner?
Well,
did they finally let you in on the secret?
You know, the thing is that when you're inside that network, you learn a lot of things that, of course, you can never tell anyone.
Right.
So when I was writing the books, I want to make it clear that I never meant to write a book, but around 2008, you know, I could see my career was starting to come to an end. You know, I know I had a few years left, but this burning interest of, was there anything real that Al was telling me all those decades ago? And I wanted to start to do field research to determine if there was anything to this flying saucer phenomena, which I had been around for all those years. And being, you know, in that inner circle of all the people who work on the base and who also have little sources of information or stuff that they picked up around the water cooler, or if you're on the inside, you notice things that, of course, the people on the outside will never know about. Mm-hmm. And it's this preponderance of information and evidence that you collect that gives you this gyroscope of telling you you're on the right track. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a framework upon which you can hang other little things that come your way that might seem insignificant to a casual observer. Mm-hmm. And so I went forward, and my taking this guidance, these little factoids, I decided that the best way for me to answer the question for myself, and that's only the only person that I was answering this question for, was I wanted to take some of the best cases that I could get close to and the witnesses and punch holes in them. Because I thought, you know, I did the research things for my entire career, and that's a very legitimate way to approach a problem. To prove it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the very first thing we do, and I'm not going to digress here, the very first thing we do is a literature search. And we want to go, did somebody already solve this? Well, maybe they've got a piece of software somewhere I can just take or modify, and boom, I'm done in, you know, 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Or do I need to let a contract, and it's such a unique problem that I need a contractor to come in and solve it, or I'll solve it myself. So, of course, I did all this reading, and I said, well, I'm traveling now, and I'm on a project that gives me some leeway. So one of the first things I did is I found myself at Hanscom Air Force Base for a week. And at that time, I had been selected by the base commander with the agreement of all the other honchos on the base that I would be a wellness director for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I was the first director of the installation civilian wellness program. And there's a long history we won't get into, but I was basically an engineer with organizational skills that was going to try to improve the wellness of the entire population of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And as such, I was going to a lot of our other outposts around the country and setting up wellness centers there. And I was finding myself at Hanscom Air Force Base, which is not too far from Exeter, New Hampshire, which is the scene of the very famous incident at Exeter, a book which was written by John Fuller. And it explores the incidents that happened near Exeter, New Hampshire. So I thought, well, research this. So I did for a couple of years, and I had already read the books and did all this stuff. So now this opportunity comes up, and I said, well, I got to go to Exeter. So I try to retrace a lot of John Fuller's stuff. And what do I find? There were two farmhouses between which a flying saucer was seen by Norman Muscarello and two Exeter police officers in September of 1965. And I went back to one of those farmhouses and knocked on the door. Mm-hmm. And who answered the door? The son of the man who owned that farmhouse when the incident happened. And the guy was made famous in the John Fuller book. And now I'm talking to his son.
Mm-hmm.
So I introduced myself as an active member of the Air Force, you know, civilian workforce, and show him my ID and tell him I'm there to investigate, you know, all these decades later. It was the most beautiful thing. He tells me all about the night that Norman was there, and Norman Muscarello saw this flying saucer hovering over their farmhouse and their garage, and how he came back later with the police officers and they all saw it. And this guy tells me about why his dad didn't answer the door that night, because Norman was banging on their farmhouse door to get right in. And then he takes me around the town and introduces me to people that he knew witnessed that during that time span that was all going on, but they didn't come forward. They actually hid their participation in it because they had prominent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
One was an instructor at the famous Exeter School there, and he had actually owned this adjoining farmhouse, which the stable from the horses were kicked in that night because they were so disturbed by this flying saucer.
Right. Right.
Well, that information was never made public.
Mm-hmm.
But I cover it, all this stuff, my journey there to Exeter, in my first book called 50 Shades of Greys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did this with the Rendlesham Forest incident. I got to talk to Colonel Hawd, Jim Penniston, John Burroughs. Jim Penniston, in fact, is the endorser on the back cover of my third book, Swamp Gas My Ass. So I got to interview all these guys. Got to meet with them, a couple of them personally. I went to Rendlesham. I dug in. I found other information. I also had some unusual experiences there. That's covered in the 50 Shades of Grey's book. It turns out that I spent the day with Travis Walton at the Travis Walton abduction site.
Okay.
And on that day, I took photographs into the science experiment for Jennifer Stein. Now, Jennifer Stein did the movie Travis.
Right.
And it's the best representation of what happened to Travis Walton. So me and Travis went up for the day to his site, and we did the science experiment by me taking these photographs of a series of tree stumps, trees that had been cut that exhibit an unusual growth pattern in the direction of where the flying saucer was hovering the day that Travis Walton was taken. That science experiment and the results and my photographs are actually in the movie by Jen Stein.
Very good.
And if you watch it to the end, you'll see the credits.
Yeah, I need to take just a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with Mr. Ray Shemansky about his involvement with UFOs at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, let me ask you this, Ray. In your time at Wright-Pat, have we had any luck in reverse engineering alien technology? And if so, what? You know, shades of Colonel Corso's The Day After Roswell.
What we do know about the Roswell stuff, the first stuff, is it definitely came to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Okay.
And how do we know that? Well, Major Jesse Marcel, who was the one who retrieved it, along with another intel officer, said we did cursory tests on it when we took it back to Roswell Army Airfield, and we tried to cut it, bend it, burn it, smash it, tear it, and we had no luck. Mm-hmm. And he escorted a plane full of that material to the 8th Army Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth. And that's when they pulled that switcheroo and they put an actual busted up weather balloon with him, and the photos were taken.
Right.
And of course, he said that was just a setup, as did the guy who was the chief of staff for the 8th Army headquarters there, eventually signed a legal affidavit that said that material went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the material that you saw in the photos was a setup. So he signed a legal affidavit. So we know two people who were involved in the process of moving that material around stated unequivocally that it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for examination and exploitation. Now,
they signed an affidavit saying that the
material, the actual material that was collected outside Corona, which was 70 miles northwest of Roswell, from the quote crash, that material most definitely went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to be examined.
Not a weather balloon, though.
No, well, of course, they both said that it was unusual material, not of this planet. They each said that. And their affidavits are on file. You can look up the Roswell. Go to any website and type in affidavit. I'll try to think of the chief of staff. He was the chief of staff. He was Roger Ramey's right-hand man. But if you look up the story, his name will be exposed. Again, a lot of these factoids I've just basically let go. But there are two signed legal affidavits. In fact, the general and Marcel also did a video interviews. One was with the Marcel one was with Stanton Friedman, and he goes Marcel goes to great length to talk about the preliminary cursory testings they did that made them truly believe this was not of this planet. And he says it's not of this planet. And I want to say it's Bolender, but no, it's not General Bolender. Be that as it may, look up your history, find the guy. There's two legal affidavits. But here's where I want to make a distinction. Individuals out there, both pro and con, say, well, the aliens were also involved and they went to Wright Pat. In neither of those two signed affidavits is there any mention of alien bodies.
Really?
Marcel never talks about it, ever and ever. Nor does the guy who was the chief of staff of the 8th Army Air Corps in July of 1947. So that is why I'm super squishy when people say, well, there were aliens too. What happened, you know, about the aliens? I'm like open-minded enough to say, well, there's enough discussion out there that it's a possibility, but I'm 1,001% sure that whatever was recovered at Roswell went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Of that, there is no doubt. Now,
well,
I arrived there, I'm going to answer your question. I arrived there in 1973, and that material arrived there shortly after, you know, July, August of 1947. So they had, you know, 25 years to hide any of that from me. So clearly I did not have access to what they did.
Oh, it's up in the air. There have been a lot of people, now speculation maybe, but there have been a lot of people that have claimed that there were bodies at Wright Pat.
Of course.
Jackie Gleason. You know that?
No, Jackie did not say Wright Pat. Jackie Gleason said it was the Patrick Air Force Base in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, you're talking to an historian here who every once in a while will forget a name. But yeah, Jackie Gleason's claim was he was taken by Nixon late at night and they went to Patrick Air Force Base, which yeah. Patrick is basically a missile control base.
I've asked this of many of my guests, and I get the same answer that this really happened, but how can a sitting president sneak off, drive a car all by his lonesome, pick up a celebrity, take him to an Air Force base, come back, drop them off, and what, go back to bed or what? How can you do that?
That's a really good question. I actually knew somebody who worked in the White House for the president, and this was, I knew him, I mean, he died a long time ago. So had I been doing what I'm doing now, I would have asked him that question. Mm-hmm. But if you want to speculate, I would think that even though they have Secret Service protection 24/7, they probably say, here's two possible scenarios. One, they were accompanied by Secret Service.
Okay.
And they call it Secret Service because they know how to keep a freaking secret. And so they said, look, if we're going to do this, you're going to come along with us. And you're not going to say anything. And those guys are trained and they never said anything. And there's so many of them that they would never know who accompanied them unless they looked at the service roster for the night and went, oh, it was Joe and Jim. And we need to talk to them about it. But see, this comes out so many years later that you can't go back there. And those rosters are destroyed after, you know, so many weeks. Right. So they probably, my theory is they were accompanied. They had a car, you know, a presidential type car, and they picked up Gleason. It easily gets them through the gate, and they did that. The problem I have with that whole story, not that I don't believe Jackie, but you have to have the need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's now a conspiracy because not only, you know, when you get onto the base, I mean, you can cut the hole in the fence and get onto a base. You'll be shot, but you can still get on. And then you've got to know where the stuff is. Then you have to get past locked doors. And then in all likelihood, and in that case, there's probably two or three more levels of security that you have to get to. Mm-hmm. So just getting on the base you still have 3, 4, 5 levels of security to get through. So you need somebody to do that for you. So now you have a conspiracy because you might need 3, 4, 8 people to get you to do that. You need the building manager. You need the guy who has the combos to these vaults you're going to be walking through. Get in the door. It would take an extraordinary amount of planning because nobody is going to let anybody, even if he's the president of the United States, get past a lock that he's responsible for. That's a career ender and a federal offense, and you're going to prison if somebody finds out.
Right. So that's my argument with that whole scenario. But yeah. It is what it is, you know.
I find it – I'm only 5% a believer in that. The other 95%, there's just too many burning hoops of fire to jump through.
I know. But the scenario where he had Secret Service with him, Nixon did, that I will believe. But the story was always Nixon showed up in this car, Nixon was driving, and the two guys went there all by himself. That I don't buy. I can't buy it, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of that's unaccounted for.
Yeah. So how did your nuts and bolts UFO research morph into alien abduction cases?
Well, that's a great question. It was at my very first UFO conference, which was in Fountain Hills, which used to have the International UFO Congress. Mm-hmm. And I really love that place. So I finally said, I think it was 2012 maybe, that I want to go to one of these things. I want to put my finger into the hole, so to speak, and mm-hmm. Do the Doubting Thomas. I want to get close enough to these cases and people so I can blow a hole in it. Sure. And then I can blow this up. But what was happening is, starting in 2008, doing field research, the more I started to talk to people and that sort of thing, the more evidence was compiling that there was something to this. So I thought, well, I need to dig really deeper. So I'm sitting in the audience at the very first talk ever for me at a UFO conference. It's like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm all excited. And a couple sits next to me. A guy and his girlfriend. And so the talk ends and they introduce themselves to me. It's a lady named Victoria. And my second book is Victoria's Secret Truth. It turns out it's about Victoria, the lady I met the very first day at the UFO Congress. And how I got from that point to the book is an interesting journey that I'll try to condense here. It's the very first talk. It's my very first UFO conference. And the boyfriend turns to his girlfriend and says, "Do you mind if I tell him?" Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I only know their first names. Mm-hmm. What is this guy going to drop on me mm-hmm. in my very first hour at my very first UFO conference? Mm-hmm. She said, "No, I don't mind." And then he goes on to tell me that his girlfriend believes that her eggs have been taken and fertilized and used in a hybridization program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there was a camera on my face, now I, the guy that did Candid Camera,
right.
Alan Funt. So I met Alan Funt at a fundraiser. I sat next to him at a fundraiser in California one night.
Okay.
So it was an amazing night. A friend of mine was part of this thing. I flew to California, did this fundraiser, sat next to Alan Funt, met Clint Eastwood that night. In fact, I'm looking at a photo of him and the menu from that night that he signed. So I have this flashback to Alan Funt when this guy is telling me that his girlfriend has alien hybrids on a spaceship. And I'm thinking, where is Alan Funt? He's getting me back for all the bad jokes I told him that night at dinner. And so, and I'm, you know, there's like 1,000 people in this room, and my mind is like, I don't know what's going on. So what happens is, you know, I'm meeting people. Of course, I'm not telling anybody, I don't have an agenda, except I'm looking for the truth. And so, you know, I'm questioning some of the speakers during the session when they've done their talks, or I'll hook up with them at their book table, buy a book. And so I'm just trying to grab all this information. But from time to time, I'm running into Victoria and her boyfriend. I find out later that her boyfriend also is an experiencer. But we don't really hang out or anything. It's just, oh, hi, how are you doing? And, you know, I'm kind of like, do I dare talk to these people again? And now, as a couple of years go by, I keep seeing them at the conference. And so we get a little bit closer and we're talking. And then I can't remember the year, 2016, maybe. So I've been going there for 3 or 4 years. And at that point, I'd already written 50 Shades of Grey's. And what I did is, in 50 Shades, I looked at the Exeter, Rendlesham, Travis Walton and Wright Patterson stories, and I tried to punch holes in those, and I couldn't. And I was talking to somebody one day, and I said, "You ought to write about this. This is you've got information that's unique, and you're now the Wright Pat guy. You should share this." So I did. It's called 50 Shades of Grey's: Evidence of Extraterrestrial Visitation to Wright Patterson Air Force Base and Beyond. I know it sounds like a PhD
I'm
dissertation.
going to say, is that the title or the first chapter?
Yeah, that's and so Victoria sees this book, and now the conference is over. I think it was 2016, and I'll take $20. The casino's right next door, so because we're at the Wekopa Resort Center there, and there's the big, beautiful conference center and the casino. It was all over, and so I said, I'm gonna let my hair down, get a beer, and my first book was there. And so I was a friend of mine allowed me to use her table to sell my books, and I got to sit next to Stanton Friedman the whole week. So I go into the casino. I talked to 1,000 people, and there is Victoria. Now this is like 4 years after I first met her, and every time I talked to her, she said something else that was building up this catalog of things. And I said, there's a story here. So I cornered her. She was at the $10 blackjack table. And I said, hey, you know, and the odd thing is I went in to play $20 worth of slots and then get the hell out of there. And I don't know what told me to go and wind my way through the entire casino and find the blackjack table. Like an inner voice of some kind said, and it was all smoky, so I had no reason to. I'm a non-smoker. Hey, former wellness director. But something told me to go, and sure enough, it led me to the table she was playing at. So we have this conversation, and I say, you know, you've got this great story. I'd like to learn more. It took me over a year to convince her to write her story. She said, they're all disconnected. There's no, but I could see from an outside point of view, I could see there was something to it. And so I started to dig, and then, you know, I started to talk to other people who, you know, did research in that area. And so it was just this great story. She had so much evidence. And then, of course, her grandson's an experiencer, and she had photographic evidence of the night he was taken. I mean, this was mind blowing. I wound up spending a couple of weeks on site where they live and interviewing the grandson, interviewing her friends, you know, going to places where different things had happened to her, and just becoming convinced that there was a story here. And so I wrote Victoria's Secret Truth. And I know it's a long answer, but that's how it happened.
Right. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell, and we're speaking with investigator and retired Wright Patterson senior engineer, Mr. Raymond Szymanski. Okay, so Ray, you were mentioning your book, 50 Shades of Grey, Alien Shades of Grey, Victoria's Secret Truth.
Yes.
What's the connection there with the abductees?
I had made friends with Yvonne Smith.
Okay.
And Yvonne Smith is one of the world's leading hypnotherapists that deals with the abduction phenomenon.
Right.
And I was able to use that friendship to bounce questions off of her as I was researching Victoria's Secret Truth and Victoria's case. And if I could not convince myself that there was something truthful to this, all that research would have just gone into, the gray file and never would have seen the light of day.
Right.
But thanks to people like Yvonne and specifically Yvonne, I was able to actually witness Yvonne doing a hypnotic regression. And this hypnotic regression was filmed by a Canadian broadcasting company. And so I got to see the authenticity of how something like this could be used productively and how the therapist, as opposed to these debunker accusations, are leading the witness and all that. None of that happens. There's no benefit to them to do that. There's no benefit to the client. There's no benefit to the therapist. So I could convince myself quite quickly by seeing somebody who had these wonderful credentials and had done thousands of these to convince me that you could get good, truthful information doing these hypnotic regressions. And one of the linchpins of Victoria's case is that Victoria has been regressed by three of the world's foremost hypnotic regressionists. Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who wrote the foreword for Victoria's Secret Truth, he regressed Victoria twice, Yvonne Smith, and Barbara Lamb. And I was given the privilege of getting copies of all of those regressions. So I was able to hear word for word, breath by breath, everything that Victoria shared with those world-class regressionists. Plus, I was able then to go round robin and talk to some of those people in person about the case, or in the case of Dr. Sprinkle, by telephone, and discuss specifically, to the extent that they could, Victoria's case and other questions that I could ask them in confidence that would convince me that this was authentic, that this could not be faked, that the correlations that I could share, because they did not have access to the other tapes, and I did. And I could bounce things off of them. And of course, I had Victoria's permission to do so. So I was kind of the insider, being the only person on the planet to have all of these and permissions to dig deep. And after I did my due diligence, I decided that this was a story that needed to be told. And that's how I got in with confidence, that I could understand what was going on and that I could put a stamp of my approval, whatever that means, for the reader.
Have you ever had your own personal sighting or contact experience?
I've had two. One was I was up in Michigan and I was up early because I was on a golf trip. And I think we had like a 7 o'clock tea time. And I was up about 4 o'clock in the morning and I had my Heavens Above app on and I was looking at satellites in the sky because I'm up in a little cottage on a lake, far from anywhere, very clear sky. And I see a satellite that I'm interested in going across the sky. And there are two bright magnesium flare level lights following the satellite. And they're 50 times bigger than that little dot in the sky. That's a satellite. What is that? And I was able to follow it. I was looking, that's due west. And I was looking, I think it was a USA 242 was the spy satellite that it was tracking in the sky. I was looking due west. I think on that date, it was probably about 45 degrees above the horizon. And I was able to watch it maybe about 45 degrees as it moved from the west, traveling northward. And then it got behind some trees. But there were these two things, and there's no way that those were satellites. Now, it could have been, It could have been like a space station, bright. But whatever was up there was either self-illuminating that bright or was so big that it was 50 times the brightness of the satellite. And then one day I was coming home. I'd had that traffic accident, and I was coming home a year later. It was December of 2011, a couple months after I had retired, and I was driving home from that therapy, and I saw a craft. It was December 5th of 2011. It was about 200 feet in front of me, just over the top of a two-story building. Couldn't be more than 100 feet. And we had one of those low ceiling days where the clouds are 100 feet off the ground. It's a weird phenomenon we get here every once in a while. And I had the moonroof of my car open, and I saw this thing float. I saw a shadow, something, you know, hit the windshield, but I didn't hear anything. So I'm coming to a traffic light, and I'm trying to hit the brake and not hit the car in front of me, but look in front of me underneath the roof of my car to see if I could see anything, because I'm near the base, and if anything casts a shadow on my car, it's got a big loud sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't.
Right.
So I'm going, you know, quickly, holy shit. And I'm looking down, and I see this scalloped kind of thing, which I was able to then compare its width to the width of the building. And I took measurements out there, and I could estimate it was about 90 foot wide.
90
and
foot.
Wow. It was 90 foot from side to side.
And how did it leave your sight?
Well, it slipped into the clouds.
Okay.
And that building was there. It literally was above the treetops, which were maybe, you know, I didn't measure them at the time, but, you know, I do that distance thing with the stick and the distance, and I calculate it, and they were like 110 feet tall. So it was just above the treetops. Now it's going in my direction, and there's a car in front of me, and I'm going, get out of the way. There's two lanes southbound. And, you know, like I was going to beep the horn, but you don't do that in my neighborhood. So it goes, and I watched it for about 7 seconds slip into the cloud bank.
Okay, so it was above the treetops, and then
goes right into the clouds. There was kind of like, I would say, a brief opening in the clouds at that low level.
Mm-hmm.
But as it got towards the building there, that's got a Subway and cake shop and whatever, a carpet store, I only saw the back end because that was the angle that I had. I had a very shallow angle. It was almost directly in front of me. I would say maybe 5 or 10 degrees to the right. So I'm almost looking entirely at the back end. I saw the thing, and I'm driving, but it was gone in the clouds. And when I got home, I drew an image of it on a piece of paper, which I still have in my files. Okay. And I published a copy of that and the story in my first book.
Very good. Your first book being Swamp Gas or?
50 Shades of Grays.
50 Shades of Gray.
50 okay. Shades of Grays. And I do hope we get a chance to talk about Swamp Gas here, because I think that's kind of like my
Actually, we've got like 10 minutes left. And I did want to ask you before I let you go, what do you feel the alien agenda is?
Hybridization. That's part of it. And it's funny, but once you start to do abduction research, and you have to study all the masters, I'll call them. So this is 2025, 20. So in 2023, I was one of the speakers at the MUFON International Congress held in Cincinnati, which is an hour from where I live. So it was a great fit. Love the conference, love the people I work with. But the theme of it was, you know, aliens, friend or foe. And it was perfect for me because I had written that book about Victoria and her family,
mm-hmm.
and done all that research. So I had read all the masters, Hopkins, Mack, Lamb, Sprinkle, Smith, you know, the list goes on. And I was very familiar with them. And I got an education that you don't get unless you read their stuff and then you have personal interaction with them. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of nuances to this. But when you do that research, when you read about the master, read about their works, and then you get to talk to a lot of them, and then you talk to a lot of other abductees, which I have, because what happened is when people read my book, and these are personal friends or coworkers, they came out to me and said, I've never told anybody about this, but mm-hmm. here's my story. And so having all of that, it becomes very, very, very clear that you can trust these people because you knew them, quote, in a different lifetime. You knew them professionally. You knew them as Dr. So-and-so or, you know, highly reputable, accomplished people. And they've never even told their family. But it was such a catharsis. One told me, I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
It blew me away.
It's like when I wrote my first book, I've told this story on my show before. I let my sister read it. And, of course, she just read it because she didn't believe in UFOs, very Christian lady. And but she read it, and I spoke about abductees and what they did. And she wanted to know if there's more books out there like that. So I sent her a copy of Bud Hopkins, Witnessed. And she said, David, I want to talk to you personally. So what's up? She says, why is this woman having the same experiences that I'm having? And I said, oh boy, you're an abductee. So that's how that got started. We found out a lot about, like I say, when she was hypnotized and regressed, she went back to that day of our sighting. And that's how we know that we were abducted at the point in time. So very quickly, because we got like 6 minutes left, you know, being a native, a Michigan native all my life, in 1966, the swamp gas case in Ann Arbor has been, it's always been in the public eye. So what gave rise to this term coined by J. Allen Hynek about, swamp gas?
Great. And this story, will bring it to conclusion, has to do with me being inside this network that I mentioned earlier. In 1966, southeastern Michigan was inundated with flying saucers, and the reports to the police were coming in from the police. They were some of the key witnesses who saw these flying saucers hover within a couple hundred feet over their squad cars. And some of them watched these flying saucers cavort for 4 hours at a time. So there was absolutely no problem understanding their truth. Hundreds of witnesses came forward. And Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the chief debunker for Project Blue Book in the U.S. Air Force, was ordered to go to Michigan and put a lid on it. And when he was done, after 2.5 days of investigation, he held a huge press conference at the Detroit Press Club, and he told the world that the two events, the two principal events that happened in Dexter and Hillsdale, Michigan, were nothing more than swamp gas. And President Ford, who wasn't president then, but he was a highly ranked congressman, held a congressional investigation, but it all blew over. Harold Brown, who was Secretary of the Air Force, went in and lied about it and gave the Air Force top cover. And it basically went away amidst a bunch of angst by the people who saw it. Now, fast forward decades later, and I've already written these other two books, and I'm really not doing anything, but I'm stubbing out two or three other books at the time. And I come across a tip that there is somebody who lives nearby that might have been an interceptor pilot in Michigan at Selfridge Air Force Base in March of 1966, when all the swamp gas stuff was going down. Mm-hmm. And with the help of the network, I was able to identify this individual and run him down. And when I did, I introduced myself to him, told him who I was. I had worked at Wright Pat, had this interest. I wrote these two books. And he said, well, now, you might want to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, give me copies of your book. I'm going to read them. And he did. Called me up. He said, I've got something I want to tell you. And the reason he wanted to read my books is he wanted to see how I was going to treat this subject, because he had a story to tell me and it was something fantastic. It turns out he had kept a secret from everybody, his children, his wives. The only other persons who knew about what had happened to him were the controllers that day out of Grand Rapids that were vectoring the two F-106s around southeastern Michigan, his wingman, his base commander, and the people that eventually wound up debriefing him. They were told, best you not say anything. So I find him, he reads my books, he invites me into his house. And I said, well, now, I've made to understand you're a fighter interceptor pilot. You may have heard about this thing that was going on while you were there in 1966. And one thing led to another. And I finally said, if you don't mind, the next time I show up, I'd like to record this for posterity. Mm-hmm. So I got my little cell phone, turned it on, the selfie mode, hit the video. And for the next several months, I recorded over 30 hours of interview with a man by the name of Colonel Gary Kent Carroll. He retired as a Fulbert colonel. He was only a captain when this happened in 1966. He's an American hero. He's won the Flying Cross. He's won all kinds of medals for being a jet jockey. He had over 4,000 hours in fighter interceptors. And basically what he told me is he and his wingman intercepted a flying saucer in southeastern Michigan in 1966. They saw it visually. They got it on their radars. They tracked it. It was recorded on their radars. When they were debriefed, they were able to show that evidence to the people who debriefed them. Those recorders were never seen again.
Oh, of course. No.
They were reusable recorders. They were never put back in the inventory. They disappeared. So Swamp Gas My Ass is based upon the over 30 hours of interviews that I did with Colonel Carroll, his official Air Force records, the Air Force records of his co-pilot, the official memoirs that his co-pilot wrote. I was given those by his family. A former top secret Umbra NSA document is part of this.
Okay, Ray Shemansky, I want to, where can we go to, where can our listeners go to find out more of your work?
Get the books at Amazon, or there is a bookstore in Fenton, Michigan called Fenton's Open Book. They can buy autographed copies of all my books at Fenton's Open Book, or the United States Air Force, the National Air Force Museum here in Dayton, Ohio. Get online, and they also sell autographed copies of my books. And I will be in Michigan twice this summer. I'm going to be in Wyandotte we'll put it up in July, and I'm also going to be in Clarkston doing live presentations later this
Wyandotte,
summer.
Wyandotte, let me know when you're coming to Wyandotte, where you're going to be, because Wyandotte's just right down the street from my house.
I'm at the Wyandotte Library, and I'll be that we already have a contract, and I'll be at the Clarkston Library. It's going to be late July. The dates are on my phone.
Okay.
I'm going to be at the Wyandotte Library giving a talk on the 25th of July. And right now there is a potential for me to be at the Clarkston Library on 23 July, but that has not been contracted yet. So that second one is a possibility.
Ray Shemansky, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your truths with us. And thanks again. I hope we can do this again, because I got a feeling you got a lot more to offer.
I do. Okay. I do. But I have to leak it just one piece at a time.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thanks, David. Really enjoyed it.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.